You are listening to the Kerberos podcast with a K, available on Kerberos.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo.
It's the podcast, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Christian Corley. I'm the editor of Kerberos.com. With me is James McLean, and our special guest this week is Gareth Kavanagh. Hi, chaps.
Hello. Hello.
Everyone all right?
Yeah, can't moan.
James, you all right?
Are we sure this is Gareth? It's not Brian.
No, it's definitely Gareth. Unfortunately, Brian's still not 100%, which is why he's not with us this week.
That's what it could be. Brian, bit of a throat thing.
It could be, yeah.
Well,
Brian, we bad throat. He didn't have a bad throat, though, did he? Brian. But Brian with a bad throat sounds like Gareth. No,
I'm not sure I like that.
It's definitely Gareth. Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, we're going to do a slightly more in-depth podcast this week rather than last week's kind of five-minute effort. That was about 35 minutes, but surprisingly short. So we're going to kick off with the American Doctor Who. What if Doctor Who had been American? This stems from an article on BuzzFeed, which isn't entirely 100% original, because upon searching and looking into this over the past few days, I've noticed a few other people have suggested this over time. But the basic idea is that Doctor Who was an American show with the first Doctor played by Burgess Meredith, who you probably best know as the Penguin, Batman, or as that bloke in
Adrian,
Rocky.
Adrian in Rocky.
Is that his name?
Yeah, Adrian.
Is that his name?
I did it, Adrian. I did it for you. You know, you must remember that.
I thought that was his wife's name. Is that his wife's name?
Right, I think we've established that a guy's name is Adrian.
Yes.
Burgess Meredith.
Burgess Meredith.
Yeah, he was called Mickey in Rocky.
Was he?
Yeah.
Oh, well, there we go.
Second Doctor.
So not Adrian. After all this, Adrian's the wife. Right, okay. Yeah. So Meredith. No, not Meredith. What was his name again?
We've started so well on this.
Second.
Right, I just think it's kind of good because, you know, you've got to make sure that people are listening. Now, if you're too fluid, people are just going to drift off. If they actually have to listen to try and understand what the hell you're talking about, it keeps them bound.
Hey, Gareth, it's worked for us for 3 years.
Staples them. I know you and your warp is all shiny, polished and perfect, but over here, we don't do things like that.
Yeah, well, that's fine. You know, a little bit of a, you know, we like to cross
wander
tracks every now and again, you know, to where all the rough kids play.
So following on from Burgess Meredith, the BuzzFeed article suggests Dick Van Dyke as the second Doctor and Vincent Price as the third Doctor.
Yeah, you see, I quite like that because I know that in some of the comments people went, Dick Van Dyke, that's a terrible idea. But I think it's quite left field. I like that.
Yeah, I like it. You can see Vincent Price as the third Doctor, that's that kind of... Because John Pertwee did a lot of horror, didn't he?
Yeah, it's just that sort of splendid, you know, sort of, you know, velvety cloaks and things.
Did you know John Pertwee doubled for Danny Kaye?
It seems to make an awful lot of sense.
Yeah, there's a film, I can't remember what the film's called, but there's a film where Danny Kaye's character comes to the UK.
And
he didn't travel to the UK. So they did interior shots that were obviously set up to look like the UK, but for the exterior shots, they used John Pertwee in Longshot.
Well,
with a second unit. Yeah,
that's a super factoid from
it's
the
not bad, that one,
on that
it?
Side of yeah. town.
Fourth Doctor, Gene Wilder.
Love that.
Yeah,
love that. Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, fifth Doctor, Carl McLaughlin.
Yeah, left field. Quite like that.
Sixth Doctor, Christopher Walken.
Yeah, not right. Not right.
In many ways.
I feel that's overcompensation.
Yeah.
Someone gave a suggestion I quite like, where it was John Goodman.
All right.
Which would have fitted more. That's the one I looked at and I thought, no, I'm not sure about that. Who would be a better American sixth Doctor?
Okay, can I ask what...
Ronald McDonald?
Okay. Well, what are your guys' criteria for an American Doctor? Because I mean, the early ones, you could almost be arguing that they sort of have a slightly Anglo-British sense to them. People like Meredith and Vincent Price. Later ones, obviously, we're talking about ones which are quite quite well-bred American, like John Goodman or, you know, or whoever you said. What are your criterias for what an American doctor should be? I mean, a British doctor tends to have to be sort of slightly eccentric, quite quite traditional in the English stereotype to a certain degree, or British stereotype.
Well, maybe we could answer this by establishing who Tony Shalhoub is.
He's a monk.
Oh, right. Right.
Right. You've lost me here, but keep going. You know,
Monk, the television show about the guy who has OCD, who's a detective who hasn't got OCD, because, of course, if any of these American shows actually specifically diagnose any of these quirky traits that they make their characters have, which we can laugh at, it becomes awkward.
Yeah.
So, you know, well, Sheldon hasn't got Asperger's, even though clearly he has, because if he has, then we're all laughing Asperger's people. Monk was a detective who had massive complexes over virtually everything, and he couldn't touch anything. And so I could see where he would actually be, because he was quite an eccentric character. Therefore, I can see the logic in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll give you this. I can, in the Sixth Doctor's a tricky one, because there isn't a American network chief on Earth, even in the most advanced stages of yellow fever, that would have allowed Colin Baker's costume to ever get on screen. So I suppose we don't even have to worry about that.
It could be argued that there isn't an American TV executive on Earth who would cast Christopher Walken in the lead.
So really we're looking for like a comparative to Colin Baker, rather. I mean, Tony Shalhoub's got curlyish hair. Is that the comparative there? Is that?
Yeah, I guess.
Is that really?
Is he quite small? Is he small like Sylvester McCoy?
He was the seventh, was he?
He's the seventh.
Okay,
yeah.
Right, yeah. Christopher Walken is a sixth, seventh. Yeah, okay. I mean, I was on a little bit of a bent on this. I was thinking, the criteria for the Doctor being is not so much of literally who compares to the Doctor of the, you know, as if the continuity was exactly the same sort of personalities for each Doctor. I see now.
I think that's what makes it an interesting little.
Yes, it does.
I suppose.
I ain't quite cooked. I ain't got the hook. I ain't got the true.
Yeah.
It would have helped if I'd found the article, but Christerbrus is so hard to navigate. I mean,
it's
honestly,
not on Christerbrus.
I thought you said you'd linked it to Christerbrus somewhere.
No, I've sent you. No. There's a link in the email that I sent.
Oh, I don't read emails.
Yeah, I know you're too maverick, aren't you? Yeah, I know.
Yeah, emails.
Listen, don't worry about this. This is par for the course.
No, it's interesting. So Tony Shalhoub, I can sort of see he could do a sort of Sylvester sort of thing. Yeah. So who's the eighth then?
Jeff Goldblum, apparently.
Yeah, I love that.
Okay, yeah, I could see that.
And then we move on to Nicolas Cage as the ninth Doctor.
Yeah, I like the logic.
Yeah.
That was pretty good.
I kind of like that myself. Sam Rockwell as 10.
I'm not sure who.
He's in Iron Man 2.
Okay.
He's the main kind of. He's the businessy bad guy in Iron Man 2.
The problem is Iron Man 2 is so similar to Iron Man 1 and Iron Man 3. I get them mixed up.
Remember the Russian chap with whips.
Yeah, he's the guy who pays for his research.
Oh, right, yeah. Oh, well, that's a little too vague for me to be able to comment on, I think.
Okay, and then Donald Glover as the 11th Doctor. I'm not familiar with Donald Glover.
No.
Don't know what he's
good
been.
Good doctory name, though.
Yeah, and then kind of tapping into complete obviousness, Bryan Cranston as the 12th Doctor.
Oh, right, yes, yeah. Now, that is ace.
Do you think? I knew where it was going, but by the time I got to the fourth Doctor, I know it's going to be number 12 here. If they go to 12, I know it's going to be 12.
Well, aren't you clever?
Well, no, I don't think so. And Harrison Ford as the War Doctor, which I really do like.
Yeah, I dig that.
Now, of course, the thing about an American Doctor Who is that thing that what they did in 1990, whatever it was, in the show that eventually became the TV movie, they had a Bible, didn't they?
Yeah.
So an American Doctor Who that started in 1963 would have started with a Bible, and it wouldn't have been called Doctor Who, would it? It would have been called something like Time Lord or something. You know,
well, we already have this in a way with Inspector Space Time.
Well, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Which is ace. I don't know. Would they have had Bibles and things
in the 60s?
You get a feeling with the original Star Trek that, yeah, by the time Fred Freiberger turns up, they really feel like they're making it up that week.
Well, yeah.
They did. I know. Yeah, they did have a Bible. I do think they did have Bibles. I find it a bit of a moot question because I can't see any network outside of a publicly owned system commissioning Doctor Who in any other country, really. It's just so bizarre, because it's just something really is very hard to pitch. I know they did pitch it, but I just couldn't see you pitching that comfortably on the idea that American Network would, you know, the advertisers and everyone behind it.
And yet, I think we are not far off at some point, you know, in the next 10 years. I think there will be an American Doctor Who.
Do you?
Probably.
Yeah. Well, I think at some point it's going to come off our screens, and I think that there will be an American Doctor Who that starts from scratch the way they want it, and has a new mythology which follows the beats of our own Doctor Who. But I think at some point it's definitely coming, no doubt.
Well, if they do that, then I want a manga Doctor Who.
Oh, no.
Yeah, kind of one without the other.
You'll just have vampires in it, and an awkward relationship where the male doesn't understand that the female is really interested in, oh, no, that is Doctor Who.
And schoolgirls, definitely schoolgirls.
I have to say, just looking at the article, the BuzzFeed article, looking through, it's kind of... Someone might have, yeah. No. It's kind of interesting, because... In a sense, you wonder, because if Christopher Walken had been the Sixth Doctor, you know, and you did have, say, I mean, Tony really would have been quite young to have done it in 1987, because it's based on his age as he was in the 2000s when he was doing Monk. Mm. But it'd have been, the show probably wouldn't have gone off air, because you've got some very strong actors there playing, you know, if you take those archetypes. I don't know. I could imagine it'd be interesting to see where the show would have gone with this sort of history. I agree with Gareth. It is a fascinating sort of concept, and it seems simple and boring and predictable. Oh, what if America did a Doctor Who? But somehow, I don't know, it sort of works in the whole alternative timeline sort of thing, doesn't it? Mm. Imagining Gene Wilder playing the stories.
Fabulous, isn't it? I mean, I can really see that.
Gene Wilder in the Ark in Space.
Yeah. Vincent Price I can see as well, yeah. Yeah, it's very good. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Any more thoughts on that?
I hope you didn't have an hour's worth of content typed in for this one.
No, I like Kyle MacLachlan, actually. I could see him, in a sense, I'd imagine that Peter Davison would, if we take Kyle MacLachlan, obviously they're basing, because these are all based often on one role they've done, and Kyle's is obviously based on Twin Peaks.
What would Kyle have done by then?
Though? Well, he wouldn't have done much. It was sort of about June time, wasn't it? A little earlier than June. But, I mean, if it's obviously the idea is based on his Agent Cooper persona.
Yeah, you look for someone who would have been about the right freshness and age group. That's right.
Yeah, and I think that in that sense, if he had played I think Davison would have liked to have been able to play something a little more like Agent Cooper, who was a little more distant, perhaps a little less obviously emotional and a little more detached, a little more like how he does on The Big Finish, I guess. So in a way, it's kind of interesting in that sense, because you could say that these define a little how they might have wanted to play the characters. I reckon Colin Baker would have liked to have played the Doctor as Christopher Walken would be given the Doctor if he was playing the Sixth, that with his Sixth persona.
Complete with Christopher Walken's strange intonation of every other word?
Well, I mean, Christian Walken,
you know what you're getting with him.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it depends on who they're basing it on again, because it depends on the archetype of what character that they play. And I would think they would be deciding Christopher Walken based on his performance in the Weapon of Choice music video.
Yes.
So he doesn't say anything through his entire era. He just dances it.
Do you know what we're missing here, though? We're missing the vital component here, which would be the showrunner. You know, and I can see a version of Doctor Who produced very successfully in the early 80s with Glenn A. Larson as the showrunner and the Hoff as the Doctor. I can see that.
Every other week, landing at in some sort of farm owned by a woman, a widow with her son, who is being hustled by
Cybermen
or someone who just wants to take over their land.
Romans.
That's about a third of his plots, aren't they?
They are, really, yes. But that's the kind of person who would have ended up with it.
It's just, it is a funny concept. I think sometimes when we talk about this, it just reminds me how, and I agree with you, Gareth, now that it's become an established norm, I could see Doctor Who being done in America. But outside of that, when you look at Doctor Who, you really realise how much it was indicative of the sheer sort of slight artisan and openness of the 60s, where the, you know, everything wasn't so certain and things were still developing, and there was not much room for evolution because everything was still very conservative, but there were just facets and pockets of space to move and do something, risk something. But then, you know, at the same time, you take Adventures in Time and Space, which very, very eloquently illustrates how even there, there was a lot of good fortune on Doctor Who's side. You know, it didn't have an easy birth. So I don't know, maybe America could have done it. I just can't think of anything as quite as bizarre and as abstract coming out of 60s America.
Well, that's true.
The Doors?
The Doors, that famous television series, The Doors.
Yeah,
I mean, it would have been up against things like the Jetsons and the Flintstones, I guess, which probably would have smushed it flat.
I think it would have been a more simplified concept if they'd done it, in a sense that, you look at Doctor Who, it sort of does play as a very sort of odd pitch. You know, it's a person who travels through time. We don't know who he is. He's alien, but he looks exactly like us, dressed in all the stuff from our past, in a police box, which is bigger on the inside for no real apparent reason. It travels through space as well. He has, it's all very hodgepodge idea. There's nothing very streamlined in it. So I reckon it would be a far more streamlined idea. The time machine would be a far more formalized thing.
Does have, you know, the driving force, the conceptualizer is Sidney Newman, who's North American, and you know, there's a very popular stream of thought, as we know, there's a very popular thought which says actually what made Doctor Who different to all of the children's stuff that had gone before is Sidney Newman's very sort of polarized morality, you know, which is all, you know, good and evil, which he picked up from his love of comic strips and American comic strips in particular, which wouldn't have been as widely circulated over here at the time. So, you know, Marvel Comics, DC Comics, that infuses it. So even though it is quintessentially British, I think without that element, it just becomes, well, let's just do A Tale of Two Cities this week. You know, let's do H.G. Wells next week, then let's go back and do I, Claudius the week after. I think without that moral centre, which he puts so firmly there, it dies after 13 episodes.
But then you could also argue with Sydney, who I think we should point out, just because we've probably got one single Canadian listener, when you say North America, obviously it's still North America, talking Canada, not, he wasn't American, he was Canadian.
No, he's North American, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I know, I'm just sure that was going to come up in one of the comments. Actually, he's Canadian, not North American. Yes.
Canadian is interesting, because it's a cultural melting pot of both British and American.
Absolutely.
The comics would have been there, but they would, and French, so they would have got our TV, so he's
I was protecting you from the pendant by being a pendant myself. But I was going to say that Sydney also, though, was very cautious about some of the more popular aspects of what became out of Doctor Who, you know, with things like the Daleks and yes, exactly, you know, bug-eyed monsters. So in a sense, it's I think what's so fascinating about Doctor Who, and as I said earlier, what Gatiss managed to transfer so well earlier this year is that while Sydney was a massive force in it, Verity's position was extremely important as well, as was the way Hartnell did it. It was such a melting pot of different perspectives in the right time, at the right place, just about making it at the right moment, that created a catalyst to have this show, which has been unparalleled, really, in all British, in international television.
I think in 50 years' time, you know, I'm having this conversation with someone, when we're at the 100th, I have a feeling that the internet will be 50% Doctor Who and 50% porn by then. I think it's going to end up being, it's going to end up being the most important show ever made, for bizarrely. I had this conversation with Maureen Lipman a few weeks ago when she was bemoaning, telling about the Omni rumour, and I was saying about how, you know, there's Doctor Who's, and she goes, oh yes dear, I read about those in Nigeria. She goes, what a weird world we live in, there's missing Pinters and missing Dennis Potters, and all we give her stuff about is Doctor Who. And I thought, but that's how it's gone, it's right. It's transcended everything else in archive TV, arguably.
I mean, I think what's so fascinating about that perspective is it just shows the transient nature of I'm not going to be rude to her and say snobbism, but because it is what generally it is people
that.
Believe.
No, it is that.
But it is a snobbism based. I mean, it's like people who say, you know, God, look at how English language, you know, it's getting terrible, it's getting truncated. Well, you know, English language is always truncating and changing, and the stuff that we consider classical or proper English now was not 80 years ago. And yeah. It's the same with things, you know, Shakespeare in its time was not the most classic, highbrow theatre that people think it is now. And so, you know, in a 50 years time, Doctor Who could be seen for those classical elements that, you know, the classical stuff today is considered, as you say, more highbrow and more relevant to especially to certain to actors, maybe. Yeah. I think that's the kind of funny thing, because I think there is a lot of levels to Doctor Who. And, you know, Shakespeare wrote his plays with political angles and with a certain, you know, populist angles as well, in the same way that Doctor Who's written with, you know, a certain rush to populism and to consumption. You know, just because that's the case doesn't mean that it can't be appreciated and loved for, you know, the style that it is. And I've just been watching Mind of Evil and just thinking,
I think the argument's been won with Doctor Who, and I think that's the curious thing. Is that, you know, I mean, I go to Missing Believe White. I've been there the last 2 years. It's terrific. You know, I watch some wonderful stuff, but I'm very aware that the audience every year is there just hoping that something missing from Doctor Who will turn up. And yes, it's lovely that we get to see rare stuff and interesting stuff, but really it's become almost like the Dead Sea Scrolls of missing TV. It's curious.
I think it's amazing. And I think it's amazing that people, and I'm not talking about Miss Lipman because I don't know her, but, you know, we'll begrudge people watching tons of Doctor Who, and then they'll go and watch Hamlet 50 times in the theatre. And you think, well, surely you know the play by now. So, you know, what is it? And it's what it is. It's about the actual experience that they love. And it's the same with things like Doctor Who. It's not so much about trying to be critical about it. It's about an experience that you get from it that means that you keep going back to it. And as you say, I think the beautiful thing with Doctor Who as well, and this is what Shakespeare doesn't have either, is it has such a continuity now of over 50 years. There's a historical fascination to it. I watch Mind of Evil, or as you say, if we get the missing episode and you get Web of Fear, you're looking at it for its contemporary aspects and how it sits within that continuity, how it sits within the time, or you take the Sunmakers, the political aspects of it, you know, it's brilliant.
Oh, I love the Sunmakers. Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, although sometimes Doctor Who is at its best when it's just telling a rattling good yarn. Sometimes it misses the mark when it tries to be political in a clumsy way.
Yes.
You know, sometimes it does feel a little bit like the little bit at the end of the He-Man cartoons in the 80s. You know, when it does it right, it's great. When it gets it wrong, you know, it's not so good. But yeah, you're right. It's going to outlive, you know, William Hartnell. Had he not done Doctor Who, none of us would know who he was, apart from maybe scholars of...
Carry on films.
Yes. Maybe this Carry On scholars. Now I think he's going to outlive everyone as an icon.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Where's your segue, Corley?
I'm gonna say we've.
Sorry, we've
covered a
coughing fits in the middle of all that. So, I don't really have a segue, unfortunately, because we're going into kind of more kind of sad territory following on from that. But, I mean, the whole American Doctor thing is a very interesting topic. But, I mean, I'd be interesting to see just... I'm more interested in just general alternative Doctors as well, not just an American Doctor Who series, but, like, the whole concept of alternative Doctors. So maybe that's something that we'll come back to in future.
There was a great piece in DWM on potential female doctors, which I really enjoyed. That's going back a few years ago, but that was really well thought of. I think Margaret Rutherford is the first doctor. And,
I remember this, yes.
It was a good piece. It's there to do. We'll have to do an animals doctor, you know. The first doctor is a sort of old tortoise or something, you know.
Meerkat.
Tom Baker was a meerkat. Yes, he's quite meerkatty, isn't he, actually? Yeah. Or is that just a bit weird?
Possibly. I wouldn't like to say. Well, let's press on. Now, we've heard in the last few days on the 7th of February, Chris Barry, the director of Doctor Who for 14, 15 years, and also directed the first Dalek story, has passed away. He did more than Doctor Who. Did All Creatures Great and Small, Zed Cars. Or as a recent article in The Mirror would have you believe it, Zed Cards. Didn't see that one. And yeah, so he's passed away. He was getting on. He was 88, and I mean, he did the Demons. He did a few other. I mean, you guys, have you got any particular favourites, Gareth, of Chris Parry's work?
Oh well, you know, I mean, he's very important, actually.
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
great champion. Of his stuff, I watched the Demons again a few nights ago. Funny enough.
Okay.
Brilliant. It just looks and feels like $1 million. Everything about it is quality. Yeah, brilliant. But do you know what my favourite of his is? It's Creature from the Pit.
Right.
Really? Yeah. Yeah, it's a left field choice, I know. But that season 17 is Doctor Who at its most popular ever at any point in its history. And I think Creature from the Pit has not only the look of absolute quality, but it's got a sizzlingly funny script that's underrated from Fisher. And I think that Tom Baker's just enjoying himself, and you can see the joy in every scene, and he brings that out. So, yeah, my little toast to Chris Parry is going to be the criminally underrated Creature from the Pit.
Okay.
Until I get to see Power of the Daleks.
Yes. Well, along with Power of the Daleks, you also did The Savages, The Romans, The Rescue, Daleks 1, 2, 4, and 5. The Demons, The Mutants, Robot, and Brain of Morbius.
Oh, Brain of Morbius, yeah. Oof.
Which is
all good.
Yes, it's all very good. Yeah, yeah. Mm. James,
I don't know. I'm trying to think of it from a sort of directorial perspective.
Okay.
Rather than because, you know, obviously there's so many melting ingredients that go into that sort of melting pot. Creature from the Pit, I've not seen in years. If I'm not even sure I've seen it in its full entirety at all, to be honest. I might have to try and see that, maybe. Who knows? Who cares? I think, I must admit, I enjoyed the approach to the Romans, even though, again, it's a bit of a left field, because a lot of people find it doesn't work, because it is obviously a slightly slapstick and parodied. But I think that was a bold attempt, and obviously, you know, that falls down a lot on the direction. Ultimately, I think I'd have to sit with the Daleks, because those first couple of episodes of the Daleks are pivotal to sort of setting up that, to set up not just that story, but that sort of approach, that platform for Doctor Who. And they're pretty much faultless. There's nothing really in those two opening episodes I can think visually or in the way that the scenes play out with the actors that is wrong at all. It's brilliant. So I think probably the Daleks for me.
Okay. Now, for the in the interest of clarity, and I would go for Brian Morbius. I think Brian Morbius is one of the most superb Doctor Who's ever, and it's got some excellent performances in it. So why not?
I thought he did more, actually, off the top of my head. I thought he did more Doctor Who than that.
Well, he did Downtime, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The video spin-off.
Yeah,
one.
Yeah. Great Intelligence, wasn't it?
Which is interesting. I think that's quite a body of work. I mean,
it is, yeah.
And he did lots of other stuff. He did some, I mean, as we say, All Creatures Great and Small, Zed Cars, Paul Dark, many other shows.
Dramarama. God, that takes me back.
Did he do some of those?
Yeah, apparently. Yeah.
No, there is, obviously, he's passed away, so that's...
I'd love to have met him.
Did you not meet him?
One of the people I never got to meet, right, and I bet he'd have been fantastic. And obviously a man of great patience, because, you know, he's handled, you know, it's the debut stories, you know, to handle Patrick Troughton, you know, which must have been so stressful for everyone.
Yeah.
And indeed, you know, Tom Baker's debut, you know, coming after the Colossus that was Pertwee, that must have been, you know, those are pretty tough gigs he's handed there.
Yeah.
And they're pretty variable as well in terms of tone and style within all those.
Completely. Yeah.
So that's kind of cool as well.
And he's obviously a big fan of Tristan Carey, because he uses him several times for the incidentals.
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm.
Okay, so he passed away. He was 88. Now, initially, reports said that he died at home, but it turns out that he fell at a shopping centre.
Oh, crikey!
On the escalators, and the doctors were unable to revive him when he arrived at hospital. So that's really, really sad.
That's very sad. I suppose the other thing about Chris Parry, which is probably worth talking about, is it did unfortunately also begin to wrap into the Omni rumour, in that Ian Levine sent out a very exasperated text that said,
you know, I can't believe that, that Chris has passed and hasn't been able to see Power of the Daleks,
yeah.
which
yeah,
I don't
yeah,
think was
yeah, yeah.
perhaps the last thing he thought of, you know, as he passed our mortal plane. But it's interesting to see how even, you know, it seems to stir up all sorts of emotions. And I can see where Ian's coming from, even though it's not right to blame anyone. You do think, well, it is a shame in a way that maybe there isn't going to be any more value-added material if stuff is recovered, because, you know, these guys are getting older and older, and you know, the chance for them to re-engage with this material and give us their reflections is passing us by, unfortunately.
Yeah. Mm. Yes. Yes, it is. Okay. Oh, well, that's sad news, and our thoughts obviously go to Mr. Barry's family. Indeed. And if you just watch one of those classic stories you mentioned earlier to pay tribute.
Revisit Creature from the Deep. Not Creature from the Deep.
Creature from the Pit.
It's worthy, and it reeks of quality.
Okay. Now, you've probably noticed, the listener, if you weren't paying attention early on, that the other voice on this podcast isn't Brian. It's Gareth Cavanagh, the mastermind behind the Warp Warp magazine, or the co-mastermind behind the Warp Warp fanzine, and former chief of the Las Ogari
yes.
top venue in Manchester. How's life?
Well, it's been strange. I mean, obviously, I left the pub on the 6th of January, so that was a very strange last weekend. So we had a big party on the Friday, which was great, and I handed out chalk to everyone that was there, and people chalked their own reminiscences on the walls. So it was all very groovy. So some filth was written up, of course, but some really interesting stuff as well. So creative. And
that would have been some cleaning job.
We left it on there for them.
Yeah.
So the brewery turned up, and you know, and I said to them, I said, look, I know you're all very fond of good quality market research. Here you go. Here is some feedback for you to enjoy, chalked by our loyal customers. It went down terribly well, as you can imagine. But you know, the other strange thing is having to empty the pub and then having to empty, shuffle stuff around between my mother's and my tiny flat, which looks like a storage room at the moment.
Does it look like Del Boys?
What?
Does it look like Del Boys?
It is like Del Boys. It's completely like Del Boys. Can't you move all this junk? Junk, this is my stock. You know,
you don't have a salad dish from Manchester Airport on the balcony.
No, and we don't have boxes full of alarm clocks. But what I'm trying to say is I found some of the most incredible stuff that I didn't know I had. I found things that I found two pieces of Dave Gibbons' art that I forgot I had.
Right.
I found, yeah, that was a pleasant surprise. I found, I used to do flyers and help manage a band in the 90s. And the flyers I designed were all ripped off panels from Steve Dillon's Doctor Who Weekly art and just redoctored with the word Charmer in there, which was the name of the band. And found them. I found a box of Warp Warp 1s, which have now all sold, more or less, which is great. I found all sorts of weird things that I just didn't know I had. So the last month has really been about sorting through all these things, and I'm watching lots of telly and chilling out, because I'm out of work at the moment. But do you know, there's worse things than being out of work. It's quite nice in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not you know, claiming anything off the state. I'm just, you know, living and existing until everything's sorted. But it's nice, you know.
So our listeners who will be fond of visiting the Las Ogari for Doctor Who events might be wondering what's going to happen to Doctor Who events.
Well, what's happening there? Well, let's see. My first of all, the lovely group Warp is now we moved to another pub, and then I had it all set up. I knew the guys, and then I saw the guys on the meeting, and they said, oh, we're all leaving next week. So I thought, oh, we're like the plague of pestilence that's shutting pubs down in Manchester. So we've moved to another pub, which hopefully will still be there, the lovely Britain's Protection. So we meet in the Britain's Protection in the Snug every last Saturday of the month. Because, of course, they're redoing out the last, I'm told, in decking out and huge expense. And one of the stupid things they've done is they've taken the Snug out.
Oh, dear.
So my little tertiary control room has gone. Very short-sighted. So So we're meeting up. As for events, yeah, they're very much still on the cards. My good pals at Fab Cafe are going to take over the live Doctor Who screenings when it comes back. They're also going to show Game of Thrones and all the sort of nice things that we used to do. They'll be going on there. And there will be some cons in the summer.
Okay.
And there'll be hopefully a couple of audiences with, because I've got some nice, interesting people that aren't overexposed, like when we had Warish last year. And there will be a themed day con at Fab Cafe. I can't say what it is now, but it's a really superb, exciting theme that hasn't been done before. Even Phantom haven't thought of this. You know, so it'll be brand new, exclusive for Manchester, very exciting, and we'll have some interactive drama elements to it as well. So something new. So it is. And as fans of Doctor Who, you know, we're used to calamity and change. So yes, the Lass has been horribly poisoned by Spectrox, but we've just regenerated into something else.
Very good.
And what about Vought magazine? I know you're working on the third one.
Yeah, Vought has got a little bit more traction, which is nice, because we've got an incredible amount of stuff banked already. The thing that we're debating now is the format it comes out in, because we were working towards it had gone into an enormous, ridiculous sort of bookazine size for the 50th anniversary, and that's just passed us by totally. So I think we're now working on a 120-page standard volume, but it is going to have some interesting audio-free gifts, and that's what we've been having a lot of chat on Facebook about. The idea is that we're going to have a flexi disc, or possibly two flexi discs, depending on, because you're going to get like 9 minutes worth of content on a flexi disc.
Yeah.
And on one of the flexi discs, we'd like to do some drama. So we're looking at things like a dramatization of one of the TV21 Daleks stories done in the authentic 60s style, you know, with a nice plummy, you know, like the TV21 record of the chase they did. It'd be in that style.
I haven't heard that. Well, I am familiar with some sort of 50s and 60s radio sci-fi, like Journey into Space and Dunder.
Have a look on the U of Tube. It's on there.
Right, okay.
It's lovely. And we've also got some really superb DJs who've been remixing Troughton music cues into sort of club tracks. So that might be one of them. Oh, they're ace. They're really just hypnotic. They're great. So that would be one. Then I think that the main copy would have, so that'd probably be 500. If we did two flexi discs, be 500 of each. And the main edition will have a CD, which will have a lot more content on. And the nice thing is, because the weird thing with Doctor Who fans, well, not the weird thing, with fans in general, is I know everyone will want to buy the flexi disc, and I reckon that probably only about 20 people will actually ever play it, but they'll be thrilled that the flexi disc exists. So there will also be a digital download, so you can have your copy of Warp with your flexi disc as an exquisite piece, but you can listen to it digitally and keep it
sounds good.
Perfect forever.
Do you think we should perhaps explain what a flexi disc is for those of us? Well, I know what one, but for the younger listeners.
For the youth element.
The younger listener, yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to explain? You probably better.
Well, it's a piece of PVC, is it?
It's a thin piece of PVC.
Yeah.
So it is
like
basically
a record.
It's a record.
That wobbles.
But it's a thin flexi, so it's like a piece of plastic that used to be. You get them in NME, and famously,
right, I've got Monty Python's tiny black round thing about 6 inches from my foot.
And they're supposed to only be played about, you know, you can play them up to about 80 times or something, yeah, and then wear out. But they are just brilliant.
Well, there's a famous Python one, isn't there? Because they did a couple on the NME. They've got the Monty Python tiny black round thing, which I've got. Then they did another one, which was which had two tracks on one side, and one track was completely silent.
That would be it, yeah.
So when you play it and you listen to it, and, oh, that's good, I'll listen to that again, and it's completely silent the second time.
Well, the nice thing about flexi discs as well is, because we love a free gift, we always have to have a free gift, and there's only one place left in the world that does them, the inexpressibly cool Pirate Press in San Francisco.
Right.
One place left in the world that does them, so that's where they would be getting done.
It's cool. It's very good. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, oh, it'd be beautiful, you know. And and interesting, and of course I'll play them, you know, because I'm mad like that. But you know, I know the reality is I'll end up with a box of them, so I can afford to rip one off the front and play it. So yeah, that's fair.
I think that's probably worth buying a new record player for.
I'm a real old fart when it comes to vinyl. I just think it sounds better, and I couldn't agree more. All the scientists out there will tell you it's the same, but it doesn't. It has that organic, crackly feel.
Well, you can feel something from it. You can valve amplifiers. You can feel the warmth from the valve amplifier. The roundness to the sound and everything. I don't have a record player at the moment, purely for reasons of sound of space. But I've got, if I just look under my desk, I've got something like 300 LPs in 12 inches.
Oh, treat yourself.
I know.
And the car boot, there's, you know, you can pick them up for now.
I'm pretty sure if you guys got a CD and it crackled and buzzed like an LP, you would send it back and say, there's something wrong with it, you old fogies.
I know, but it's just that...
You're missing the point.
I remember a load of records from the car boot, and in there was a nice WH Smith's paper bag that you used to fit a single in, and that just took me back. That was wonderful. And yeah, it is the whole, but then the effort that used to go into them, you know, a picture disc, it was great. And there was something special about a Doctor Who vinyl, even though we knew in our heart of heart they were rubbish. You know, they were advertised at the end of the program, you know, if you've enjoyed this theme tune, you can find it at local stockists. And it had a special.
I still have a bone to pick with BBC with their release of the Blake 7 on LP, where they did not use the same theme tune. They used a variation which was nowhere near as powerful, especially there's no timpanis there that was quite as good. And they've never, and you still can't get it. They still got it. You go onto YouTube, it's always the same bloody one.
We've erupted a 30 year rumble here.
It's very upsetting. I'm also very equally upset that they've still not got onto CD or on download Kevin McCulloch's 25th anniversary album, which I used to have on cassette, not on album, not on LP. I had it on cassette. All right, sorry. And I used to love that, and that's still not out. Why is that not out? Why is that nowhere? That upsets me as well. And when are they going to do some of Murray Gold's old stuff? You know, all the missing stuff that was not on any of those CDs. I want some of that stuff as well.
I do like the alternate theme tune that was on the trailer. I just discovered it yesterday. So on the old "Do You Want to Come With Me" trailer, there's a slightly different arrangement.
Oh yes. I watched
the Fireball one.
I didn't realize that until yesterday. Well, that's great. I can't wait for. Warp issue 3. So
I promise you something this year. It will happen.
Okay.
Even if I have to litho print it on toilet paper, it will you will get it.
Yeah. Okay then. Well, thanks for that, Gareth. We're going to move on to our recommendations now. As our guest, would you like to go first?
What am I recommending? A nice place
recommend
to stay,
anything. You recommend anything whoish.
Anything
who-ish. When I say who-ish, I don't mean CSI.
Right, let me have a think. Can I go last?
You can go last, yeah. James, are you ready for a record?
I guess I could.
Okay, you go first.
I'm just trying to think, because obviously it's not been
that
long.
Because I know what I'm...
Okay, yeah, go ahead, go
All
first.
Right, I'll
go
first.
See if I care. Go on.
Well, we were talking about this a couple of days ago, weren't we, when we did our last podcast?
Yeah.
We'd have our podcast very late last week, Gareth, due to my phone's ringing.
I see people know we're real now.
Christian Corley.
Hello, Mum.
You calling from where, sorry? Right.
The Omni what?
No.
I'm under arrest.
No, I don't think so. Thank you.
For
bye.
For the bushes.
That was Sky Bet.
Ah.
Trying to sell me something. I don't know.
Now, they weren't offering you, you know, money on the next Doctor Who, were they?
No, they weren't, no.
You realise that I single-handedly moved the betting markets in one afternoon on that? With Sam Troughton.
Sam Troughton, yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. I took him at 20-1 and they panicked. And I had a chat with Tom Spilsbury about this. No, with Pete Ware, because they didn't know who was being announced.
Right.
And all of a sudden, Tom got a text off Pete saying, "I think it's Sam Troughton." And they went, "What?" And then they looked it up and they went, "Oh God, we're going to have to, we don't know anything about him. Find the pictures. and then in the end, of course, it was Capaldi. But it's amazing how, yes, I was briefly a rainmaker in Doctor Who betting circles. Yeah. But
I think we may have played a part in that as well, thanks to you.
your
Morgus like machinations.
Yes, you hedged your bets very nicely. That would have been very nice, actually.
I think it would have been an interesting choice, yeah.
It's amazing how this is logic allowing us to be wrong with authority. Because I went, "Oh, he's a Troughton. No, he's the right age. RSC. Ginger. Ah, well, that's it. Magic. Bet the house, it's Sam Troughton." And then when they did the reveal, it's like, "Oh, that's an old hand. Oh, that looks very old. Oh, no, it's not Sam Troughton. But it's Capaldi. He's a good actor. But, oh, how much have I lost?" Next time.
Okay, so recommendations. So last podcast, before we were rudely interrupted by Sky Bet, I might leave that in as well, James and I were discussing the Sunmakers and the Time Monster. And then we had a little minor, small, teeny-weeny chat about Underworld, which I had never seen in its entirety.
It's good. Underrated.
So good first episode, as James mentioned. And then it goes off, and I don't think it deteriorates. I don't think it perhaps doesn't reach the heights that perhaps the first episode perhaps promise. But it's a solid piece, I think. It's really good. I was astonished. And if you haven't got if you haven't got the DVD for this, it's in the Myths and Legends box set. And it's got... those DVDs aren't packed full of extras, unfortunately, but there is a really good making of extra in there, and there's a good studio footage extra in there. Mm. And this is a superb piece of work as a piece of creative television. You two know because you've seen it.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the model work in particular is really, really strong. I was surprised by how good the model work was, and the visual effects that go along with the model work, the lights for the lighting effects. And also, you've got the whole CSO thing, which is basically takes what you've seen in the Green Death and runs with it. And I think there's something...
It's much better than the Green Death.
It is, but it's the same concept, isn't it? And then they've taken it in a completely new direction. So basically, because they ran out of funds to build the sets that they wanted for the caves, they build models and then used CSO, as BBC call it, chroma key, green screen. I was astonished by how good the actual effects were for 1977.
I've got no problem. I think there's a problem with shows like Underworld because fan thinking is shaped by the immediate reaction to it, you know, at the time. And then it's reinforced in the very early Doctor Who weeklies and Doctor Who monthlies. So this is why we end up with The Gunfighters is crap, The Web Planet is amazing, Underworld is terrible. And it's only when you actually get to see these things years after with an open pair of eyes and go, "Yeah, that's not bad. That's passed the time very pleasantly." Whereas whole bits of season 18, you know, which are lauded at the time, I would happily put in the furnace.
I have to say, I have to disagree with the two of you in the sense that I found I watched parts two to four of the Underworld in a sort of board-like trance.
All right, okay.
I can't even remember it. It just did nothing for me. It just floated. And I will have to say, it was nothing to do with the CSO. It was nothing to do with the effects. I think that they handled it as a production very well. But I just felt like so many of Tom Baker's era's stories where, and I agree with Gareth, that because they are said, Tom Baker is almost perfect. He becomes almost perfect. But there's so much in that sort of middle pocket of his era, which to me just float and do nothing. And that's one of them, I'm afraid. The opening episode is a good one. The idea is a good one in the way in its very close homage. And even the fact that it admits it at the end, blatantly, I think that's great. It just, again, it always, we were saying with the Sunmakers, it just felt like to me a story which would probably suit better for new Doctor Who in a 45-minuter. You could get through that within 45 minutes quite nicely without it feeling going backwards and forwards.
I wouldn't disagree with you. I do think there's problems with the script, and there are jumps in there that don't seem to make sense. And the occupants of the B7E, the Trogs, thank you.
Yeah.
The Trogs themselves are fine. The upper echelons of their command, they don't seem to really, their purpose isn't clear what they're doing and why they're being the way they are,
what are they mining for?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that whole thing isn't well developed enough. I don't think it's the best story by Bob Baker and Dave Martin at all, but I have full admiration for the production. I think they did.
Yeah, tell you what it has got. It has got one of my favourite guest star appearances in, and I can't remember the name, the chap who plays Herrick.
Diana
Dawes' ex
husband. Yeah.
Who's immense. He's got that, that RSC lustiness to it. He's like a sort of low rent Oliver Reed, and he's all the best for it.
Well, I was going to open today's podcast by saying the quest is the quest as well, and I forgot to do it.
The quest is the quest, yes.
Nice. It's a funny one. It's Tom Baker's are funny like that, because the more we talk about it, there's quite a few of them with Tom Baker's era. I think if you just made that 45-minute story like you can now, you could probably just get that far better balanced. But of course, obviously, you're talking about 20-minute segments each week. It's a different beast. So, you know, you're not seeing it in the same way. You're not seeing the up and down the same corridors to point plot A. We weren't supposed to watch it
all in one go, were we?
Exactly.
Watch it and then tune into something else. You know, the Generation Game was waiting for us after.
That being said, I do try to watch them episodically for that reason, and it's still...
It's
like
hard to do it weekly. I always end up doing it nightly.
Yeah, it tends to be like every 2 days or so. And there's a lot in that sort of era which just... I've actually played with family and felt them being disappointed almost because they were around when Tom Baker was. And they've got good memories.
Get the Horns and Nymon on from their living.
That was the one that pained. That's such a terrible show.
Cultural cringe, James.
That is just absolutely, it is pitiful in every way. I mean, I watched the commentary and saw them trying to justify the strengths and poor Lala trying to sort of see the good in her segments, but it was just absolute turge.
We're probably going to be talking about that next week.
Good.
Because Gareth, what I've done recently, I bought a load of Doctor Who's that I haven't seen completely or haven't seen since they were first aired.
A treat.
Or at all. So that's why we've done the Time Monster, Colony in Space, Sunmakers, just done that one that we just talked about. So next is going to be Nymon. And then I'm moving on to a couple of McCoys.
Just put your head into Douglas Adams mode and see it as a joyous, witty,
well, that might happen.
Interesting romp.
Yeah, that might happen because that happens
through,
quite
through
easily.
The land of diminishing budget, and you'll enjoy it.
I don't know, but I found it. It wasn't the budget for me. I just felt it was a boring, rubbish story. And I think, you know, as I get older and I get more crotchety, I'm going to stand by that more.
I'll tell you what, James. I've often thought, and I've had this debate with someone, and this is the dividing question into what kind of Doctor Who fan you is, because there's only two answers.
Sure.
The TARDIS breaks down scene with the spring and the amusing sound. do you love it or do you hate it?
To be honest, I'd forgotten about it until you just said it.
Yeah.
I don't particularly like it, no. But
I think that is the defining line. I think if you ask people the mad spring sound, love it or hate it, I think that almost you can almost cleave off your tastes in Doctor Who from that one scene.
You see, I don't agree, because I think that the problem with that scene is that that spring sound, in no context, unless it's done with it being a bullet to Hitler's head, is just not funny.
Oh,
and even then, I don't think it's funny.
It's pant-wettingly funny.
I mean, the springy ruler sound has never been funny. It was never funny at school. I know some people do think it was funny. It wasn't. It was not. Look, you could take your northern sensibilities of what is funny. It's not funny. We people down the south, we don't do that.
You
have someone there do it for you, don't you?
Yes.
Mr. C, I would say, watch it, and when you get to that scene, that will tell you. You need to know.
But the thing is with Nymon is that I don't think that scene is indicative of it, because I totally forgotten about it until you said it. To me, it's not the humour. Because you can say take Pirate Planet, which again has got horrendous amounts of silliness and parody and stuff that you've got to take on the chin. You've got the ridiculous inertia corridor scene. You've got the jelly babies round the pillar to escape in the car. It's stupid, but it works. I think that one works because it's an interesting story, and the stuff can be hammy and over the top, and it can work because that is what it's meant to do. In the same way, if you watch Delta and the Bannermen, you can really enjoy it for what it's trying to do, rather than trying to say this isn't Legopolis, because it's not meant to be Legopolis. So I understand what you mean. I mean, for me personally, I just find Horns of Nymon just feels a collective mess. I don't think it was intended to be. I think that may be the difference. I think Pirate Planet is very much what they wanted it to be. Horns of Nymon, I don't think, is what they wanted. I think it falls short of what they were trying to do. Well, I think Pirate Planet probably hits the mark of what Douglas Adams particularly wanted. It is all up. It's everyone's opinion. That's what's so beautiful about it. I hated it. I'm glad that you love it. I mean, as we say so many times, I'd rather love a Doctor Who than sit here berating it, because it's a waste of my time. I'd have rather really enjoyed it. So if you've got something out of Horns of Nymon, and I've got it on my shelf, it's absolutely. Yeah. So people, go and watch Horns of Nymon again. See whose camp you fall on, and see what you think of the rubber springy sound.
Or at least wait until next week when we do it as a proper recommendation.
Absolutely. they can bone up, can't they? They can go and watch
the rubber springy sound. I'm telling you that is the dividing line. But let's see.
All right, James, your recommendation for this week.
My recommendation, my first one is Horns of Nymon. I'm getting too predictable. And I was thinking of Underworld as well. And finally, the rubber springy sound in any context, even Hitler being shot through the head. Now, I've been watching, this is quite interesting actually for me, and probably not for everyone else, but I've been watching Mind of Evil. Now, I've not got through it. I'm up to the end of episode 3. I've seen it before a long time ago when it was out on VHS with its black and white episodes, and as we've said before, I mean, I think this is almost as good as Horns of Nymon. It is a really good story. It's one of the few Pertwees which does something which is actually quite contemporary and tries to dovetail two story strands separate and let them interweave, and it just gives it gives Doctor Who so much more depth than it normally has, and especially in Pertwee's era, where outside the first season can occasionally get a little simple and childish. It stops it from doing that, and I found it amazing to be on the end of episode 2 and feeling like, good lord, so much has happened. I can't remember how they managed to keep this going for 4 extra episodes. And as I remembered, I've not seen, as I say, up to episode 6 again yet, but I don't remember it ever getting boring. So it's a really rare Doctor Who 6-parter to get to the end of episode 2 and feel like I want so much more still, and not feel like this is going to be dragged out now for another 4 episodes. I'm halfway through it. I think it's one of the best stories. The only downside is I actually prefer the black and white episodes.
Yeah, it's moody, isn't it?
It's moodier. You've got some very... The prison looks better in black and white. The backdrop isn't so clearly backdropped. And it's the same with the London scenes with the windows as well. I think this... I know people would disagree, but I would personally released or done with it a release of Invasion of the Dinosaurs and this in purely black and white. And I think both those stories would look so much better for it.
Yeah, quite possibly. And I love The Mind of Evil. Do you know what I like about The Mind of Evil is that it's
the
Delgado
sound?
Story. It's a Delgado story has Pertwee guest starring in it. It's basically the Delgado Doctorless spin-off. You know, I like the way that he's logically gone, right, I'm trapped, so I'm going to set myself as an opulent crime lord. I want to have a chauffeur. I want to have a car. I'm smoking the best cigars. I've got a nice suit. And there was actually a really good book called Face of the Enemy, which was basically that Doctorless Delgado spin-off.
set in the 70s, which is sort
is
of
that
part,
the McKinty
part,
one?
Yeah.
Part I desperately Sweeney. Want to get hold of that.
Oh, have you never read it?
I haven't. I never particularly clicked with McKinty, so I avoided it when they were out. And then later on, it's like, oh my God, Ian and Barbara are in it as well. And I never got
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it's brilliant. But they're, it's almost, it's the what if, and it's what if the doctor's buggered off and something happens. And it's like, well, we've got the master locked up. Let's help him. Let's use him. It's got a brilliant twist. It's an unexpected sequel to a story you would never see coming in a million years, and it works. But don't read any spoilers, because it'll. But it's an epic book. It's an epic book.
Well, I hope they'll kindle it, as they seem to be slowly kindling a lot
of
these.
Oh, I do hope so.
Shakedown's coming out late this year, isn't it?
Yes, I read that in the article. Yeah,
yeah.
It's a good book, Shakedown, actually. It's. I remember that really well. I mean, I had the VHS, and obviously recently, Sturbris, you linked to the video on YouTube.
Yeah, that was a surprise find. That was mainly down to the conversation we had in the podcast last week as well.
Oh, right. Yes. I mean, people don't realize, yes, Shakedown, fan-made Suntaran story with Sophie Aldred, Caroline Ford, written by Terence Dix, and then also integrated into the New Adventures range as a film novel. And I'm really glad that this stuff is slowly coming out onto Kindle.
Without doubt.
Indeed. Right, so Mind of Evil.
Is someone repairing their console there?
It's not me.
This is noise. Boing. I'm waiting for the rubber boing.
I'm rustling, and these are my cockatiels in the background. So that's Sydney and Ernie. I was told, actually, they should have been Sydney and Verity, and I suppose they should have been.
They should have been, yes. You missed out there, didn't you?
Sydney and Ernie instead. So say hello, chaps.
So Mind of Evil, anyway, was mine. Mind of Evil.
So, Gareth, what have you got for us as a recommendation?
Ah, well, let's see. Well, I have a recommendation or two, but I was going to ask the listeners for a recommendation as well. So, and if you're able to collate that for us. But my recommendation, I suppose, has to be Creature from the Pit. Having eulogized about its greatness, dig it out. You will see, I think, a really well-rounded piece on greed, capitalism, xenophobia, the difficulties of conducting diplomacy in the third world context. You will see all those things. You'll see Tom Baker on top of his form, a sparkling script from one of, I think, Doctor Who's most underrated scripters in David Fisher. You get a sense of that wonderful, wonderful Douglas Adams vision for Doctor Who, as witty and literate and exciting. And it is Doctor Who at its most popular, watched by 15 million people every week. And that's something that has not happened before or since. So, yeah, Creature from the Pit.
And the Doctor given a blowjob.
Pardon?
Yes. Yes, that's true. That is true. I'd forgotten about that. I even don't mind the creature. The creature looks ropey in some shots, but there's one long CSO shot where you see the creature in its entirety in a cavern with the Doctor, and it is fabulous. So, thank you, Chris Barry, for that wonderful thing. Now, I was going to ask our lovely readers what I should read, because in the magic cupboard, amongst all the things, I found four Doctor Who books.
Okay.
I have never read before.
What are they?
I would like to know which one I should read. Well, actually, there's three I've never read and one I have read, so we'll miss that out. The one I've read is Decalogue, and riffing off the excellent Mind of Evil, the one I'm going to read again is the short story called The Duke of Dominoes, which is where the master, the Delgado master, is trapped in 1920s Chicago because someone's stolen his TARDIS. So he sets himself up as a gangster kingpin, the Duke Domini, which is based on a character from a Wallerian card game. Wonderful. So don't worry about that. So the three books I have, which I would like a recommendation on which to read next, is The Time Travellers by Simon Gurria, which is a First Doctor, First Susan, Doctor, Ian and Barbara, alternative time.
That's one with the traffic lights on the cover, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Craig Hinton's Quantum Archangel, which is The Sixth Doctor and Mel, and is a sequel to The Time Monster. And Lawrence Miles, Dear Larry, The Adventuress of Henrietta Street, which is an Eighth Doctor novel. So I would love a recommendation on which one to read.
Okay, then. Well, we'll put that into the podcast show notes and let the commenters do their work.
Yes. But thanks for inviting me on, boys. It's been a blast.
It's been great having you
here. Yeah, love it, love it.
And that neatly brings us to the end of this week's Customers Podcast with a K. Thanks to Gareth. Thank you, James. And we'll speak to you next week. Bye-bye.